Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. It's Legal Roundtable Day. I had a chance to take a closer look at some of the day's legal issues. They include U.S. Supreme Court deliberations on gerrymandering. The ACLU goes to court to change police tactics during protests. And there's an attempt to change St. Louis's marijuana laws. Joining me in studio are Bill Freivogel, journalism professor at SIU in Carbondale. Mark Smith is associate vice chancellor and dean for career services at Washington University. Judge Douglas Beach is the St. Louis County Circuit Court presiding judge. Thank you all so much for being with us. Judge, great to have you with us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I can't have three lawyers in the room on a day like today without getting some feeling from each of you about this whole Manafort story in Washington. Of course, he's been indicted, and I guess the rest is we wait to see what happens with the rest of it. But, Bill, I know you've been following it all day. What's your take on what's going on right now?
Well, so Manafort, who was Donald Trump's campaign chair for 3 months during the election, June through August, was indicted along with his right-hand man, Richard Gates. And they were indicted for money laundering and lying to the government. Both to FBI and to the IRS. Basically, they were getting tens of millions of dollars from the pro-Russian Ukrainian political party, the one associated with Vladimir Putin, and they were sending that through offshore accounts and then bringing it into the United States. And so, for example, Manafort would use the money from the offshore accounts to buy real estate in New York and fancy up his Hamptons house. And then he would borrow money off that real estate, claim, for example, that his daughter was living in one of the houses so he could get extra money, use some of the money for his nice suits and his nice cars. And he lied to the FBI and to the IRS about it. He wasn't paying for this. Now, the other sort of interesting thing today that happened today was there was also an announcement of a plea agreement by Papadopoulos, who had been one of the first Trump foreign policy advisors. And this was for lying to the FBI. What he had lied about was that he had lied. In some ways, this is actually more directly relevant to the whole question of Russian collusion with the Trump campaign, because what he had lied about is he had said that he had a connection with a Russian-associated professor who lived in London, a London professor who had ties to Vladimir Putin. And he had told the FBI that and this Russian professor told him that there was all sorts of dirt that the Russians had in the form of emails about Hillary Clinton that they wanted to pass along to the Trump campaign. Papadopoulos said that conversation had occurred before he became an advisor to the Trump campaign. In fact, it occurred afterwards. And it then led to discussions all the way through the summer with top campaign folks within the Trump campaign on trying to make connections with the Russians to get that information. And recall, this is all occurring at about the same time that summer meeting occurred between Trump Jr. And the Russian lawyer who we now had direct ties to the Kremlin.
Judge Beach, were you surprised at how quickly Bob Mueller had launched this process against these guys?
Yes, I would say very much surprised, because usually the federal government, particularly when they're looking at criminal activities, really takes all the time they need. So to me, that as having had some background in some of the criminal side, this probably looks like a way to squeeze somebody to get some information, because they usually, by the time they come after you, they've got every I dotted and every T crossed.
I have to suspect that Paul Manafort does not want his picture taken in an orange jumpsuit. The Armani suit is something else.
They're a lot less than $5,000. I don't know.
Mark?
I was surprised just at how clumsy this – I mean, if the indictment is true, you know – we were talking before the show. Money laundering usually works. It's a way to make illegally sought or gained money appear legitimate. And so you run it through some cash business or something like that. That's what all the drug dealers do. And he's not doing that at all. He's just buying properties and then he's taking out loans. But he didn't do anything to disguise the money that he used to buy the property. So this seems to me to be a pretty, if they can prove it, pretty clear-cut case of tax evasion. I mean, that's how they got Al Capone, and that's how they're going to get him, it sounds like.
And Bill, Mr. Papadopoulos should have called Martha Stewart before he decided to lie to the FBI.
Yes,
right?
Yes, he should have.
Yeah, that's a bad thing to do.
You know, just the one other thing I might say is that Donald Trump is engaging in an incredible display of distraction, sort of Wizard of Oz, like, you know, don't look what's going on here. This isn't collusion, even though the Papadopoulos involves collusion. What in fact is going on is Hillary Clinton and Uranium One and the dossier. Yeah. I mean, this is just a massive attempt at distracting the American people, and you know, it's been pretty effective so far.
why would you become such a public person involved with this if knowing that you're doing this? I mean, you bring the spotlight on yourself. Wouldn't you be kind of
Keep it low key, right?
But fortunately, a lot of times people that do criminal stuff, they're not all as bright as they think they are, and that's how we catch them.
Yeah. Well, we'll be hearing a lot more about this during the course of the day and in the coming days, needless to say. And NPR has been covering it all day so far and will continue to do so. Well, let's move on to some other things. My personal observation is that the gerrymandering situation in this country is probably one of the most significant things going on in the political world today. Great influence on election outcomes. The Supreme Court heard the gerrymandering case earlier this month. Do we get any sense of leaning of the court as a result of the question that came out of that hearing?
I think it's leaning whichever way Justice Kennedy is leaning, and he didn't say much, and so we don't know. I mean, I think it's probably a court that, I mean, you never can predict what's going to happen with the Supreme Court, but it seems like it's a 4-4 kind of split. And
Kennedy was he was the deciding vote last time this came up, and he punted on it then. I don't think
he keeps saying, well, you know, if we could find a judicially manageable standard that we could use in gerrymandered cases, then I think there could be some political gerrymanders that were unconstitutional. But he's been, you know, concerned that if there's not a judicially manageable standard, that then the Supreme Court's going to be involved in redistricting every election district in the country, which is what the conservatives said. There was a really interesting exchange in this argument between new Justice Gorsuch, who apparently is already struck his colleagues as opining a lot with comments from the bench, one of which here was, what does the Constitution have to do with this? And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who didn't actually appear to be paying that close attention, shot back, what about one man, one vote? I mean, what her point being, one man, one vote was the sort of famous 1960s Supreme Court decision based on the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution that required courts to be involved in redistricting cases. So it was a pretty quick reply.
but you see Roberts being very concerned about the legitimacy of the court, his fear that if we cannot come up with a really easy test that everyone understands – to the man on the street or the woman on the street, it's going to look like we, the Supreme Court, are saying or are micromanaging this process, which is supposed to be left to the states. And so Gorsuch talks about that, the lack of a easy test. And there were a lot of social scientists in there saying, oh, no, it's easy. We have tests. We have computer models that you can use. But I think you're going to see – whether Roberts is in the majority or in the minority, a lot of talk about how they're getting into a dangerous area.
I'm concerned. Interesting, as I'm the trial judge, so I'm the guy that has to figure out what they're saying. But to say that we can't do anything because we can't come up with an easy way of doing it, I didn't know there was anything easy about that job. And if they don't do it, I don't know who is.
Yeah. Would you agree, Judge, that aside from money, that the gerrymandering, the redrawing of legislative districts to favor one party over another is really a very, very significant part of our process?
Oh, I think – and that's why I think they have to deal with it because it blocks people in and they're guaranteed to get reelected just because of their party, and it doesn't really make any difference what their viewpoint is. And a couple of places, what, Arizona, I think, they did attack that, and they've got some citizens can come in, and it really goes back to balancing the one-man, one-person vote.
A lot of talk about establishing commissions in various states to do this.
But a lot of times the commissions get pegged. I mean, we have a commission in Missouri, but we had pretty Republican districts. Mm-hmm. A celebrity sighting at the oral argument was Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's formed apparently a not-for-profit called Terminate Gerrymandering. Remember, he was the Terminator.
And, yeah. Who could forget?
Yeah, exactly. It was one of the great roles, right? And so he was out giving speeches beforehand and apparently was in the courtroom while it was going on. So I just found that interesting.
Well, he's got a lot of time on his hands.
Yeah.
These days. Before we take a break, let me get on to one other issue here. Alderwoman Megan Green has filed a bill to bar city police from enforcing federal or state laws against marijuana. Green said her bill opens the door to use, selling, and distribution without government interference. It would also allow city residents to grow up to 10 marijuana plants. Can a city ordinance trump state federal law?
No. Right. I think it opens the door to it being declared an unconstitutional law if it passes.
They tried that with the minimum wage, and they thought saw how far that got. But how well are we doing at really enforcing that law now anyways? I mean, not very well, I don't think.
No. Now, you do have states that have, you know, legalized marijuana for medical uses and for other uses, and you had Congress then pass a law that said the Department of Justice can't go after those states because, I mean, a state can't say you're not violating federal law. But there was like kind of this the stalemate or because the Congress wouldn't allow the Justice Department. But now that law needs to be renewed. Sessions has come out saying, I want to fight this. So I think the St. Louis one would not stand because Missouri's just going to come in. But I think even in places like Colorado and California, there may be a shift. And you've got all these businesses that have been being built up.
And St. Louis has relaxed its marijuana criminal law somewhat. Police are a little bit taking a little bit of easier on people who are found to be in possession. Let's take a break now. We'll come back and talk about some other issues. This is Legal Roundtable Day. Our guests in studio are Bill Freivogel, Mark Smith, and Judge Douglas Beach of the St. Louis County Circuit Court. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our legal roundtable panelists, all attorneys. Judge Douglas Beach is with us from the St. Louis County Circuit Court. Mark Smith also with us, and Bill Freivogel, our regular panelists. The ACLU is asking a judge to limit police response to protest. The ACLU of Missouri wants a court order to limit when officers can give dispersal warnings or use chemical agents. ACLU says that police officers are allowed too much discretion in response to protesters. And I just wonder if this is a realistic request of the courts. Thoughts?
Well, I would just I note that during the Ferguson protests, for example, as I recall it, there was an order of the federal court here that said that police were required to give some sort of warnings in connection with use of tear gas and those kinds of agents. So I don't think that the ACLU is off base, and say, they're sort of using this. They had this sort of term that that chemical agents, pepper spray, was like the new fire hose. A reference to Southern protests and fire hoses against demonstrators. And so I think judges would be very leery of tying police hands and dealing with a very complicated, dynamic situation on the streets. But on the other hand, some of these some of the testimony in this case seems to involve cases where there was the use of these sprays on people unnecessarily and without any kind of warning.
Right, and I wasn't at the hearing, but the city council representing the city didn't seem to be denying. They were saying, "Well, these were isolated incidents. It wasn't." But the allegations in the ACLU's complaint was – their petition was – they were pretty serious. People taking off goggles and spraying people in the eye and just kind of shooting people for fun, it sounded like. Not saying they're all true, but I think you're – so the judge in this, I don't envy their position because on the one hand, you don't want to say you can do this, but you don't want to tie the hands of the police, well, and they've got to be prepared – if things start to go south.
That's exactly the point, Judge, tying the hands of the police. I mean, an officer would have to go out there with a rule book of some sort to see exactly what he or she could or could not do.
And I think that all of the courts, we're very reluctant to be in a position where we have a black or white rule, particularly on something as dynamic and changing second to second and happening out in the street. Mm-hmm. But I think that they're trying to deal with, it sounds like from the evidence that they have, that there have been at least isolated instances which are incorrect and should be allowed. Mm-hmm. But to put a blanket out there is one thing to have a blanket rule you must warn versus going to something say you cannot use this tactic. So how then do you put the police officer in?
Right.
You're putting them in jeopardy.
And you want to use non-deadly force, so you don't want to do anything that discourages that would some of the things like they said in the Ferguson case and maybe also saying things about supervision that we that you need to have lieutenants there and the lieutenants have to give the command or something like that. Who knows? But then you're kind of micromanaging a situation that...
But we're talking about deadly. We're talking about people who are injured. People, they may not be permanently injured, but when you go, if you have somebody going to point of pulling a goggle up and then spraying them, that's something that cannot be allowed to happen. But on the same token, it needs to be handled individually. And if you punish the people that do violate the others' rights, then I think that you should be curtailing that back into a more manageable situation, I suppose.
A couple of things related to law enforcement to discuss on our program today. The city of St. Louis has pledged to let most people charged with municipal offenses go home without having to pay bail. Judge, what's the significance of that?
Well, and, you know, since Ferguson, we've had such a dynamic change. I'm absolutely immersed in the situation in that the Supreme Court of the state of Missouri on September 20th of 2016 passed Rule 3704, and it basically – it doesn't change or add law necessarily. It just puts everything together, and it puts, for the very first time, a direct responsibility of supervision on the presiding judge of the circuit. That would be me. In St. Louis County, we have 90 cities now. We used to have 91. We have 77 courts. I've got 63 judges. And all of those people and all the courts had been pretty much allowed to act on their own. And Ferguson brought to light some very clear violations where people were not showing up for court on a $125 speeding ticket and getting a $500 fine or fee charged on a warrant for their arrest because they failed to appear. Well, if you're making minimum wage, which is $13.47 an hour, and somebody's going to tell you you have to pay $500 to get out of jail, you know, you tend not to even show up and wait until you're caught, which is what's happened. So now I actually and literally go out. I have two full-time employees, or one full-time employee and one part-time employee, and we are out there. We've been out there since last year and specifically since March, and we are reviewing the courts. We review procedures. We're trying to standardize procedures throughout St. Louis County. As a presiding judge, I have the authority to issue to go and investigate. I can make references to the Supreme Court if I find someone who's not following the law. And we do have places in which if you owed $500, they'd say you're not going to leave to here today until you come up with $100. Those things are not occurring anymore, but we still have – there's just so many out there. And some of them – one of the big things we've done is to go for this clear separation of powers where the clerk can't be the clerk for the court and the clerk for the prosecutor and the clerk for the police department because – which they were. Mm-hmm. But some of that's because they had small cities that can't afford – and then you see the massive amounts of money that small cities that had 2 or 3,000 employees – excuse me, citizens – bringing in $2.8 million in traffic ticket fines. So those things were clear abuses. Now we're back into – we investigate. We go and make – we just stop in. And we have I field complaints. Our city defenders or SLU people will call if they have a problem. I will go out or my staff will go out and we will investigate. Most of the times we're tweaking things that, you know, but the appearance of evil is worse than the evil itself. So I'm really preaching that you've got to look transparent. Mm-hmm. You can't have the prosecutor and the judge having a conversation and then in front of all the folks and then turn around and say, okay, I'm now going to issue whatever my judgment's going to be.
Well, what would the role of the Missouri Supreme Court be in this? Doesn't it have the ability to order changes, as some of those that you have mentioned?
Well, and they have the authority to order changes. In 1974, the Constitution of the State of Missouri said that all divisions of the courts, including municipal courts, were divisions of the circuit court. So that means our ultimate is the Supreme Court. So they have rules and process about process and procedure. The idea of whether or not to cap fines or how much the fines can be, that's up to the legislative. Whether or not and there's a city as an example. The judge of the municipal court for the city just issued an order that said we're not going to be using money as a basis of releasing people. Well, other states have done that. Texas as a state passed state statutes to do that. Maryland has done that. Other states are starting to do that on that magnitude. So I'm not in the position as a presiding judge, although I have authority over the 77 courts. I can't tell each judge without some kind of state statutory authority that you will do it this way or you will. And there's an individual judge to decide what's to happen in his division, his or her division.
I was just going to say the Missouri Supreme Court, you know, it was a year ago that they initiated these minimum standards for municipal courts, yeah. which Judge Beach was talking about. And as I think we said on this program before, the people who have been critical, the lawyers who have been critical of the operation of the municipal courts in the past and also actually critical of the way in which St. Louis County Circuit Court had overseen those kinds of – had failed to respond to those kinds of abuses have been giving Judge Beach rave reviews on, you know, getting out there and actually dealing with the problems. And so I think there's a lot of progress. I wonder to what extent we've gotten to the point where the municipal courts, are they meeting the minimum standards? And I wonder also how well the Normandy and the St. Anne consolidations are working.
Well, we have two what we call consolidated courts, but they're not really consolidated per se, but St. Anne and Normandy. And there's 8 and 10 courts that work out of the same building. They have the same administrative staff. They help those situations in which they just financially couldn't have enough of the background of the court clerks working for and doing what they needed to accomplish. They're working very well. They're very organized. They have enough money coming in collectively from the costs which are associated with what's going on in the courts because there's a cost on each case that is adjudicated. I would love to do more. I would like to do at least one more, but there's politics. You're out there, or this mayor won't talk to that mayor, or this council doesn't like that other council. And I really, you know, although we've tried to do that, we've worked with the group 24-1, which is up in the Normandy area, and they were very helpful with St. Anne and the Normandy groupings. We are working, Karen Tokars is a professor at WashU, and she's one of my part-time monitors, and we're trying to do that politics of working behind the scenes. It would be helpful to do that, to reduce the number of places on any given night. We don't only have night court now. We're doing some day courts and some. You know, not everybody can get out at night. A lot of people work at night, mm-hmm. So they need to have a daytime. So it's a gigantic effort. But I really think we are making progress.
Is there a most glaring issue that you can think of that is kind of universal out there that needs to be addressed?
You know, what really needs to be addressed is this concept of not using dollars and cents as the way to remediate whatever the issue is. Because if you're a football player and you get charged $5,000 but you make $5 million, it's a lot different than if you're charged $50 or $60. We have a concept that we're really trying. It's a cultural change to take from everything has a dollar and cent ticket to it, yeah, to switching it over to having a way of being accountable and responsible for their actions. I was in one court one night, 120 out of 129 people voted guilty of what we call guilty with an explanation, which there is no such thing as guilty or not guilty. But people want to tell you, and they feel better about telling you, well, this is why I didn't do that. But we have a critical mass issue. They're not, something like 9.2% of all the people driving in this state are driving around on a suspended or revoked license. Hmm. And it's because they didn't pay a fine. They didn't show up in court. There's 17 different ways, including not paying child support. Well, if you haven't paid child support and they take away your license in our city, you don't have a lot of mass transit getting you places. So you need to have a car to have a job. But that's a staggering number. It's 20, 30% of our courts every night, and the municipal courts are dealing with trying to help people get that license back. But they have multiple, you go down Natural Bridge or St. Charles Rock Road, and you go 7 miles, and you went through seven cities. and so you may have five or six charges and warrants out for you. And so for someone making a minimum wage, this one woman, she was a very nice woman, very well-intended, not a criminal, but she got pulled over because they hadn't paid for their tags, the county property tax. She had two warrants from two other cities. She clearly wasn't able to drive because her license had been suspended. Her husband was sitting in the car because he had two warrants, and they had two kids in the back. And they took her in, mm-hmm. and they processed her, and they released her. But by the time they released her, we were all of our resources to someone who would be what I would say we call indigent. And indigency is basically there's four people in the family, and she was making minimum wage. She can't – we are trying – the court there was – the prosecutor was trying to help her get her license back, and it's just a big deal.
I think nobody wants to – and I appreciate what you're saying. Nobody wants to say people shouldn't take personal responsibility. But I think the real issue is all these little tiny municipalities who are using this as a revenue generator. And we had the legislation from the state that came out, but unfortunately they did one standard for St. Louis County and another standard, so it was overturned. But I think we need the Missouri legislature saying to these municipalities, this cannot be the main source of revenue to keep your city going.
We actually track the numbers now. It's that they can only keep up to 20% of their mm-hmm. gross revenues, and the rest is yeah. supposed to be turned over to the state. And we literally track that now.
On this cash pledge, cash bail pledge, however, I understand there are two exceptions to it, and that one is domestic violence, and the other is if people are picked up on an outstanding warrant, which kind of takes us back to where you don't want to go.
Certainly the domestic violence, if you're going to set some sort of a cash bond, it's based upon two basic reasons only. One is, will you appear? And if you already have a warrant out, that's basically because you didn't appear. And the other one is it a danger to the victim or to society out mm-hmm. there? So if it's a domestic violence and you've got domestic violence means we're talking about intimate partners, which means we're talking about people who – that's the victim of the allegation. So, and then the other one, but I would agree with you. It kind of sounds like we're going all the way back to this, but that warrant is generally going to be out there because they have already been determined not to have showed up. So, therefore, I need to find a way to have you come back. Is money the way? Not sure.
There's also an exception if the – I think the language is something – if in the reasonable judgment of the Division of Police, the person would present a danger of harm to a person arrested or another person. And I know that the MacArthur Justice Center, who brought that, they think that gives too much discretion to police officers rather than to the court.
Well, that makes it sound that the police officer has the choice of releasing you or not, and they've always had that choice. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't have to they can give you a ticket and a court date. They don't have to say, oh, I'm going to take you in. Okay. So I don't know that that's really a change from
moving along. Another issue here concerning dollars and cents comes to us from the city of St. Louis. Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner wants $1 million because she wants to have the from start to finish authority to investigate police shooting cases. The police actually get this process started now, so they're in essence investigating themselves. She wants to do it all. Seems to me, again, just my opinion, like that's probably a pretty good idea.
Yeah, I like the idea. I think it's you got to some way have credibility in the investigation, and when it's controlled as much as it is now by the police department investigating itself, I think you lose credibility with a portion of the folks in the city of St. Louis. So I like her idea. I think it's a whole lot better idea than, for example, the one that was in the Ferguson report, which was to have the Missouri Attorney General investigate these cases, which is something that I think people sort of, not only does Kim Gardner think that's a bad idea, but also McCullough in St. Louis County thinks it's a bad idea. So I think this idea of Kim Gardner's is a good one. Of course, it's going to require some money.
It's going to require $1 million a year, and that was what kind of got my attention. They were talking about, I think, five investigators, a couple of prosecutors, some other staff. That seems like a lot of people to do this. Now, having said that, she's apparently modeling this on what they do in San Francisco, and I went and looked at their and they have written reports for charges that were brought the fall of this year. So, I mean, you know, the stuff in St. Louis drags on forever, so they're moving it along pretty quickly.
It's a I don't know what dollars are dollars. I mean, but $1 million just sounds like a lot of money. But, you know, for our local people, the people who live here, to have the feeling that there is somebody out there local who is accountable, it's not the Attorney General's office. It's not, you know, we've got the Highway Patrol has been giving out tickets in the St. Louis now. Do we like that? So I think that – and it takes a dedication. When we go after things, we do that from the judicial side. We're having these alternative courts where, you know, drug courts, DWI courts, where there's a lot more direct attention. It really has a value to it and can give you a pretty good return.
Speaking of dollars, and we have to take a break, the Missouri public defenders have been in the news for quite a while now because they claim they're overworked, a heavy caseload. And the average number of cases for a public defender in Missouri is at any one time is 219 from what I've been reading. But now a court has ruled that public defenders can be punished for refusing to take new cases, which some of them have done. Thoughts about that? I mean, there's no question that they have a heavy caseload.
Yeah, I think Missouri has and there have been all sorts of national studies and local studies. I think Missouri is just terribly has too few public defenders. Those case numbers are ridiculous. The Missouri Supreme Court, I think, had disciplined one of the public defenders for having been too slow in handling some of his cases. This was a public defender who had some health problems. But now some of these public defender offices are saying, well, they're not going to be able to take some of the cases. The state of Missouri, these people have a constitutional right to representation. And, you know, is being one of 290 people on one lawyer's, list of clients, is that really representation? I don't think so.
We're spending $355 per case per defendant. I mean, and this is for, like Bill said, a constitutional right. This is not just the state saying we're going to be nice. We are mandated to do this. We have to. It's part of our whole system. And to underfund it like we're doing, something bad's going to happen.
Well, Mississippi chart pays
less. Yeah. Right.
We're only next to last.
Yeah. So we're 49.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But it's actually the responsibility of the it starts with the presiding judge of each circuit. If they say they cannot take a case, there's a whole process. In fact, in 2013, a statutory process was put into place by the legislature, which says that they have to come and tell me the presiding judge why they can't take that case. So what's been happening now across the state, and they've been sending out blanket, we're not taking anymore.
Right.
They are clearly you would not want to be represented by someone who doesn't have enough time to get to your case. So I think that's a real – it's been woefully underfunded for years and years and years. I think they got a $12 million boost last year, but it was just covering – it's like a Band-Aid.
Yeah.
They work very hard. In St. Louis County Circuit Court, we are working with the public defender. We're trying to find ways to move cases, to reduce cases in the caseload because they're averaging about 190. A couple of people have 220, 225. But they're in a real tricky situation. The fellow that they chastised, part of it was to say that all the rules of ethics and responsibility still apply to you, public defender. The problem is they have to take the cases. And if we're going to force them to take the case and then turn – and so their response is, oh, so quit. Well, we don't want that to happen either.
Got to take a break. Let's do that now. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion with Bill Freivogel, Mark Smith, and Judge Douglas Beach of the St. Louis County Circuit Court. He's presiding judge there. Anything more to add to this whole public defender thing? I know you.
Well, I was just saying when we were off the air, couldn't judges around the state appoint private attorneys to take some of these cases pro bono? And if that was done across the state, would it result in enough political pressure from those lawyers who suddenly have to take these cases without being paid? Would it result in enough pressure to get the legislature to do something and give us enough public defenders?
And your response was?
Well, I think yes. In fact, it was done, I think, in the late 90s where the same situation had occurred. And yes, it does bring political pressure because all of a sudden you have people who are having to give their time. And sometimes who do I appoint? It would seem you have to be across the board, so your expertise in criminal law may not be the only reason. So maybe you have to do something more than that. Michael Barrett, who's the head public defender, he under a statute, he appointed Nixon
right,
to a case when Nixon wouldn't give him more
money.
That
didn't work out.
That didn't work out too well. No.
But, I mean, and just so your listeners know, lawyers get appointed, but it's typically young lawyers. The first year or two you're in practice, I remember getting an appointed case, and then one of the partners got one, and I helped them on that. But they were both civil rights cases, not criminal cases. But you're exactly right. So if I don't have expertise in this area, then, how do I handle that? Most lawyers are pretty specialized.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of the big law firms in town, along with the public defender's office, have put together a lot of younger lawyers to give them experience in the courts.
Yeah.
And they've created a not-for-profit organization, and I think they've handled about 100 cases this year so far, trying to give them some experience in the lower cases, which aren't as significant. It's starting to work fairly well.
It may be many, many years before some of these young lawyers ever get into a courtroom if they're with the big firms, correct?
Yeah. We're not trying anywhere near as many cases, more settled, so yes, that's true.
Even when I left 25 years ago, there were partners in the litigation department who had never been to a trial. Mm-hmm. They had motions practice, but because most cases settle, business people like certainty, and they settle.
Yeah. We have a brand new U.S. attorney for Eastern Missouri. Just want to bring this up and note that, Jeffrey Jensen. He's a former federal prosecutor and was in private practice. He says that he wants to focus on violent crime and the opioid problem. Do any of you gentlemen know Mr. Jensen? Know anything about him?
I don't. He has a really interesting background,
Having
in accounting and then FBI agent and
true.
Then U.S. Attorney's Office and private practice. And I guess is he from Hush?
Yeah, Hush, I think.
So he seems – everybody seems to have very positive things to say about him, though. My only negative reaction at all, and it's totally understandable why he said this, he was asked about police cases. And he was saying, does the request, I think it was from the mayor and others, for there to be a pattern or practice investigation of police.
NAACP?
I thought it also came. I thought that she agreed. I could be wrong, but I think that's right. There had been a request for a pattern or practice investigation of St. Louis Police Department, like occurred in Ferguson. And he was saying, well, that's something that the Justice Department in Washington does. Yeah, that's true. But the Justice Department in Washington under Jefferson Sessions says, we're not interested in those kinds of – even though there's a statute that says we're supposed to investigate that. Nah, that just becomes anecdotal stuff, and we're not going to do that. So it's not really a very good answer.
Prosecutorial discretion is what they call that, I think. But the opioid problem, which is getting a lot of press and a lot of people are talking about it, but we see it in our circuit court on a regular basis. Somebody originally brought in for their first or second drug use, and we try to typically release them. And if we release them, they go right back to doing the same thing. And so, if it takes 5 months to get back to trial, they may have gone back and had and used drugs, and sometimes they die as a result of using these drugs. And so it's a really hard question because there's nothing out there that gives us, okay, you need to get this treatment. There's no such thing at the moment. So it's a really tough question.
I think it's 150 a day.
Die. A day.
They said, I read in the paper, it's the number one cause of death for people under 50 now. You would think it would be car accidents
something
or
like
something.
That. Yeah,
it's incredible.
Way above car accidents.
And it's every place. It's in everybody's neighborhood.
Here is an interesting court ruling by the Missouri Court of Appeals. It's ruled that LGBT people are protected against discrimination. The Missouri Human Rights Act does not protect against discrimination for sexual orientation, but it does protect against discrimination based on sex. The court says if an employer mistreats a male employee because the employer deems the employee insufficiently masculine, it is immaterial whether the male employee is gay or straight. Right. Interesting wording there, I thought.
So they're not saying that you can bring a lawsuit because your employer fires you because you're gay. So gay LGBT is not protected under the Missouri laws. But if I am a gay man and I act effeminately, the fact that I'm gay doesn't – but they're treating me differently than other men in the office because of the way I act, they're saying that's actionable. Mm-hmm. So they're cutting hairs here, but I think it's viewed as a push forward, at least in Missouri, of the protections of the MCHR law, the Missouri Human Rights law.
The LGBT community is saying this is an historic
I think it's ruling. A big step, but, I mean, we're still not all the way there, I don't think.
Yeah, big step, particularly if the Missouri Supreme Court agrees.
Agrees, right. That's the other big thing.
And, you know, it's a big step in this case. But, you know, at the same time, the Missouri legislature took a big step backwards in making it harder to prove all kinds of workplace discrimination cases in Missouri.
And who knows what's going to happen at the federal level because, you know, with the EEOC, they may be pushing back too. I mean, I would like to think that we're moving in the right direction on this one, but I think it's still very much up in the air.
We have a caller who wants to kind of backtrack a little bit on some of the things we've talked about. Let's bring in Ron, who is calling from Ferguson. Ron, go ahead with the question or comment, but make it quick, if you don't mind. We're running out of time.
I have two quick questions. Why was there no request for a federal investigation into the Shockley case? I could see this one more so than the Ferguson case. This seems a more obvious case to me that the Fed should have done their own personal investigation. And who makes that request? And then who made the decision not to allow a second-degree murder or involuntary manslaughter to be an option as far as the judge?
Thanks, Ron.
Well, I think that there had been a federal investigation that had concluded that there was not a federal case to be brought. It's a lot harder to bring a federal civil rights case than it is oftentimes a state criminal case. The Stockley could have been convicted of a lesser charge than first-degree murder. The judge in the case said that because he could not prove – there was not proof beyond a reasonable doubt of deliberation, that he felt that went to all of the different possible lesser charges. I myself think that probably the judge might have been able to get himself to some sort of a manslaughter, voluntary manslaughter. But that's, you know, that's second guessing him with a lot of hindsight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, let's move on. We have a question, also backtracking here, a question from Bill on gerrymandering. Why hasn't anyone proposed that counties be used as the congressional legislative districts? They have been established for many, many years, 100 years and more, and I've just lost it here. Here we go. 100 years and more, and do not change. The number of representatives could be determined by the latest census, as is currently done. That sound like a workable solution to any of you lawyers? Using the
It still gets complicated. So, you know, you're going to have to put a couple of counties, number of counties together, and many times many counties. How do you put those counties together? I don't think it solves
the problem. You don't want to discriminate on the basis of race. And if there's a large number of African Americans that kind of, you know, are in between two counties and you break that up so there's no African-American, that would probably get close scrutiny. But I think – I mean, I do think the idea of looking at some natural divisions makes a lot of sense. And, as you know, people hate that when they see these districts. I mean, even the city, you see the ward or boundaries, and they should be kind of compact. And instead, you get these little fingers that come out, and what a surprise that alderman lives there, or the incumbent alderman.
Or they're trying to get somebody out
yeah,
of there.
I mean, the reason that these districts now are so partisanly gerrymandered is that we have these computer programs that enable people to get it exactly the way the partisans to get it exactly the way they want it. Well, you can use those computer programs just as well to draw fair districts.
Where do you say we want to give county boundaries a high degree of preference? We want to give we want to have rural people together and urban people together. Whatever you decide, and it should be something where. Technology should be able to help us.
Well, all the way back to the one man, one vote is the counties don't fit nicely into that little package.
Yeah. Part of the problem with all of this is the fact that it's going to be the politicians themselves, the legislators, who have to decide what they're going to do about it.
Right.
And I think most of them are pretty happy.
And they're going to look
as long as they're
themselves.
In office.
They're the ones that did it.
That's right.
They created those.
Oh, time is moving on. Let's get to the ruling on Missouri's abortion law. The Jackson County judge Monday let stand a Missouri law requiring abortion physicians to meet with their patients 3 days before the procedure. These are the abortion physicians now. Heretofore, under the 72-hour waiting period, they could be counseled by qualified professionals. Didn't have to be the physician that was going to actually perform the abortion. Under the new law, the doctor performing the abortion must be the one providing the information about the procedure's medical risks. So they've tightened that up considerably, haven't they?
They have. And this is a circuit judge. You know, we'll see how it works out on appeal. I can see her ruling that we already have a 72-hour waiting period. So, you know, is this enough of a change for to be an undue burden? Which is sort of the standard in abortion. But it does make, you know, it makes it a lot harder to be running abortion clinics in various parts of the state if you have to get a doctor to all of those places as often as would be required by this for the doctor to be there 3 days after counseling the person. I just would like to add that at the same time, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals finally let go forward a federal judge's order applying that Texas Supreme Court case to Missouri. In other words, Missouri's law is no longer in effect that had required doctors to have admitting privileges at hospitals within X number of miles of the abortion clinic and also be designed like surgical care facilities. You know, those were struck down in Texas. For some reason, the Missouri Court of Appeals, Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals had put a hold on applying that to Missouri, and then they changed their mind. And so now that Missouri law is out, and so additional Planned Parenthood clinics in different parts of the states are going to be opened.
Judge, how much does a sitting judge keep his eye or her eye on the whole appeals process on the Missouri Supreme Court, thinking that they might be involved?
On an individual case, you're applying the facts to the law, the basic law that we have before us. Now, the rulings of the courts of appeals over time, they restructure or quantify how that law is to be interpreted. So we do watch that in the sense that, okay, have they changed what the application of a particular rule or regulation might be? On a day-to-day basis, you're not looking over your shoulder to see, oh, the Court of Appeals may overturn me if the facts as applied to the law are going to have you rule one way. If they overturn me, they overturn me. I have to do what I think is the law and what is right. It's not for a trial judge, in my opinion, to be making changes to the law. That's for the powers above us. That's why we have appellate courts.
We're going to have to leave it at there, Judge Douglas Beach. Thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations, too, to Mark Smith's wife, who was honored this week. I think we're going to have her on next time,
she'd
Mark.
She'd be much better
of you.
Than me. She's much more knowledgeable.
She's an associate general counsel at Washington University, the Missouri Lawyers Weekly Counsel of the Year Award winner.
Well, one of 22. So, all right. But still, she's was the only one married to me. And yeah, exactly. And so Lisa Braun, we congratulate her.
Congratulations to her. And thank you all, Bill Frivolgen, and Mark Smith and Judge, for being with us today. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.